this edition for Saturday, April 4th, the Centers for Disease Control says it's time for masks, climate scientists on the impact of less traffic, and a major rollback of fuel efficiency standards. Next on PBS NewsHour Weekend.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Bernard and Irene Schwartz, Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein family, Rosalind P. Walter, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, Charles Rosenblum. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments. Additional support has been provided by and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
We are bringing you our broadcast tonight from remote locations across the country for the third weekend. Many of us are in New York City and the surrounding region, but we are reporting and talking to people from all across the country. There are a lot of developments in the coronavirus pandemic. Let's get started with today's top news. Americans woke up to new guidelines suggesting they wear cloth face masks when out in public to help slow the transmission of the coronavirus. But it's unclear how many people are participating. Late yesterday, President Trump emphasized that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommendation is voluntary. Adding to the confusion, the president said he would not be wearing a mask.
The CDC is advising the use of non-medical cloth face covering as an additional voluntary public health measure. So it's voluntary. You don't have to do it. They suggest it for a period of time. But this is voluntary. I don't think I'm going to be doing it.
There are now more than 27,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19 in the U.S., and New York City remains the epicenter. Today, Governor Andrew Cuomo said New York will see its cases peak sometime in the next 7 days.
The apex is the point where the number of infections on a daily basis is at the high point, and that is the ultimate challenge for the healthcare system. Can we handle that number of cases at the high point of the curve? I call it the battle of the mountaintop because that's what it's going to be. That's going to be the number one point of engagement of the enemy. By the numbers, we're not yet at the apex. We're getting closer. Depending on whose model you look at, they'll say 4, 5, 6, 7 days. Some people go out 14 days, but our reading of the projections is we're somewhere in the 7 day range, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 day range. Nobody can give you a specific number, which makes it very frustrating to plan when they can't give you a specific number or a specific date.
More than 7,100 people have died from the coronavirus nationwide, and the number is steadily rising. NewsHour managing editor and anchor Judy Woodruff spoke with Dr. Anthony Fauci yesterday about the possibility of hundreds of thousands of deaths in the U.S.
You've been quoted as saying that you're not sure these models are all reliable. What should the American people believe right now?
Well, models are useful. They give you some idea of what to expect, and they can be useful for planning, for example, the number of hospital beds you'll need or the number of ventilators you need. But my experience over many years, Judy, has been that you have to be careful that you don't wed yourself so completely to a model, because models, as I say often, and I'll keep saying it, are as good as the assumptions you put into the model. But having, you know, lived through and experienced multiple outbreaks from HIV AIDS through Zika through Ebola, I can tell you that as often as not, the models can be misleading. So you have to use them to the extent that they are valuable, but don't be strictly adherent to it to the point where you're going to be frozen in what you're going to do.
Globally, there are now more than 1.1 million confirmed cases of COVID-19. In Spain, officials announced 7,000 new infections, putting Spain behind only the United States in the number of people who have contracted the virus. Officials also announced today that 809 people died in the last 24 hours, bringing the total to more than 11,700. But despite the grim totals, there are signs that the outbreak is slowing in Spain. The daily death toll was the lowest in a week. Countries around the world also continued imposing lockdowns to help stop the spread of the virus. In Moscow, streets are deserted as the country started its first weekend under new restrictions. In Brighton, England, police patrolled the beach, which has been closed because of the pandemic. And in Pakistan, there was fumigation in a neighborhood outside Islamabad where there was a cluster of coronavirus cases. In China, there was a three-minute national moment of reflection today. Leaders, including President Xi Jinping, appeared in Tiananmen Square. Elsewhere, traffic came to a complete standstill as motorists leaned on their horns, adding to what officials state media called a, quote, wail of grief. In Wuhan, where the novel coronavirus first appeared, all movement came to a stop as residents marked the 3 minutes of mourning that included staff from one of the city's main hospitals. The Chinese government reported that more than 3,000 healthcare workers contracted the virus and 14 died. Across China, officials say more than 82,000 people contracted the virus and more than 3,300 died. But recent reports from intelligence officials here in the United States estimate that the actual totals could be much higher. President Trump abruptly fired Michael Atkinson, the Inspector General for the Intelligence Community, late last night. Atkinson was the first to tell Congress about an anonymous whistleblower complaint last year that said the president had pressured Ukraine to investigate former Vice President Joe Biden and his son. That complaint prompted a House investigation and led to Mr. Trump's impeachment. In a letter to the Senate and House Intelligence Committees, the president said he no longer had confidence in Atkinson. According to the Associated Press, Atkinson is at least the seventh intelligence official to be fired, ousted, or moved aside since last summer. Former Vice President and Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden says he is gearing up to start his selection process for potential cabinet members and a vice president. Biden made the announcement during a virtual fundraiser yesterday and said a committee will oversee the selection process. Biden, who holds a significant lead in delegates over Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, says he spoke to Sanders to let him know he'd been working on the vice presidential vetting process and that he did not want Sanders to think he's being presumptuous about winning the nomination. For more on U.S. politics and the latest developments on the worldwide pandemic, visit pbs.org/newshour. Governor Ron DeSantis issued a statewide stay-at-home order for Florida just this week in response to the spread of the coronavirus. This came after some local counties and cities had already put similar orders in place ahead of the governor's mandate. I spoke with Stephen Mort from PBS station WUCF about the change and developments in Florida. Steve, the big news in Florida this week is that you finally have a stay-at-home order, but what does that actually mean?
That's something that local authorities throughout Florida are trying to figure out. The governor coming out this week and saying finally that there was going to be this statewide stay-at-home order. Now, the confusion comes because the governor initially said that his order supersedes all other orders throughout the state, that they couldn't go further than this order put in place. And in fact, Governor DeSantis on Wednesday night put out a clarification order making just that point, saying that all other local government orders that conflict with this, this now supersedes it. The following day, however, on Thursday, he did say that local authorities had the ability to do more, that this just acted as a floor. Now, you know, there's all kinds of confusion about this. If this does supersede local government action, then it would open the way, for example, for religious services to take place. That's been something that some local authorities have said you can't do. And in fact, we saw a megachurch pastor be arrested in the Tampa Bay area for doing just that, for holding church services. Now, whether or not the counties in Florida can say you cannot have church services, well, that remains to be seen.
What is happening on the economic front when people stop traveling to one of the big destinations that profits from that travel and even has an entire cruise ship industry that's based there?
Well, the cruise ship industry, of course, is in critical condition at the moment, and that is a big engine, particularly in the south of the state at Port Everglades and one of the largest cruise ports in the nation at the Port of Miami. The tourism industry is particularly susceptible to shocks, and this is something that we've heard over and over again from tourist industry analysts in this part of the world, that this is much, much worse than September 11th. We saw closures for a short period of time of tourist attractions after that happened in 2001. Now we've had Disney closed for multiple weeks. Disney had initially said that they were going to continue to pay their workforce, which numbers some 70,000 people here in the Orlando area, by far and away the largest employer. They'd said that they were going to continue to pay their workforce through the end of March. Well, now we have news that Disney will begin furloughing people coming through at the middle of April. So when you get those furloughs coming into force, you're going to see a lot more people added to the unemployment rolls. And in fact, the unemployment rolls in Florida have really, really swelled just over the last couple of weeks. We've seen 227,000 Floridians file for jobless benefits just in the last week. That number was about 74,000 the previous week. So this is an economy which is heavily reliant upon part-time work, temporary work, and that tourism industry.
Steve, are health experts that you're hearing from concerned that it took Florida this long, especially considering how many senior citizens are there?
Yes, they are. There have been measures put in place earlier on in the game to protect the elderly community. Particularly, there's been a ban, a prohibition on visits to nursing homes throughout the state. And in fact, I spoke to a spokesman for the Florida Healthcare Association, which is an umbrella group for nursing home facilities and rehabilitation facilities throughout the state. They do say they are concerned. I mean, a lot of people don't understand that they can't go and visit their relatives at nursing homes. Nursing homes, of course, have got to have those critical supplies. The people that work at the nursing homes have got to leave at the end of the day, and they've got to come back again. Many of them, they tell me, are implementing screening procedures, very tight screening procedures, making sure that they check the temperatures, that they check the vitals of staff when they come back. But this, as you know, we have one of the largest populations of seniors in the nation here in Florida. And of course, as we've been able to tell over the last couple of weeks, they are one of the most vulnerable communities when it comes to COVID-19. So that indeed is a big concern as well. Many hospitals telling us, you know, they're having trouble getting the equipment they need. The mayor of Orange County saying that there will in fact be a shortage of ventilators. And he put that down directly to what he called the inadequate state and federal response to this. So a lot of local leaders are not pulling any punches when it comes to criticism of both the state and federal governments and how that's left them short of supplies.
Steve Moore, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Because of coronavirus restrictions, millions of cars are no longer on the roads. The skies are comparatively free of airplanes. In fact, many human activities that cause both air pollution and the release of planet-warming greenhouse gases have stopped or scaled back. Does that make a difference in the air we breathe now and in the future of our climate? NewsHour Weekend's Christopher Booker reports.
In early March, NASA released some startling satellite images comparing nitrogen dioxide levels in China before and after the coronavirus lockdown. The first, compiled between January 1st and January 20th, shows the world's second largest economy chugging away at full steam. The second, compiled between February 10th and February 25th, shows the same economy in a near standstill. The reduction in nitrogen dioxide, the noxious gas that comes from cars, power plants, and industrial facilities, was dramatic. Suddenly, the choking air of major cities became easier to breathe. As other countries have hunkered down, does the slowing of emissions also portend a respite for global climate change? Those who have built careers studying and analyzing the atmosphere say, well, maybe.
We've looked at that over the last month, and it's possible it's a tiny bit below where it might otherwise have been, but there's enough fluctuations that are natural that it's hard to say for sure that it's deviated.
Ralph Keeling is a professor at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography in San Diego.
it's like turning down the tap on a bathtub, and you can see the tap is turned down just by looking at it. But it takes a while to notice that the level of the tub is filling more slowly. If it persists, we'll see it, but it takes a little while before the ripples calm down and you can really see the level changing.
Keeling's father, Charles David Keeling, developed the famed Keeling Curve, a daily reading of atmospheric carbon dioxide levels collected on the Mauna Loa volcano on the Big Island of Hawaii. It provides a record of global CO2 emissions.
The record starts in 1958, and it shows very dramatically and clearly this oscillating pattern and an overall rise. So it's a really beautiful indicator of how the world is changing with respect to carbon dioxide.
Looking back at any historical comparisons, which of course are somewhat difficult, how might this period compare to, say, the 2008 recession or other major seismic events that maybe altered the atmosphere?
Well, if you go to the 2008 economic turndown, I think the global reduction in fossil fuel burning was at the level of 1% or 2% out of the total. So it's actually rather small. Now, I expect that the reduction in emissions this time around will be substantially larger than that.
What happens when we return to, if we return to, business as usual, when people start flying again, when businesses start traveling again?
Yeah, I mean, if the economy comes back, we'll be sort of back where we were before, except for, you know, lessons we've learned or patterns of behavior that have changed. So, and I think this is mostly an experiment in human behavior. The natural world does not respond to changes in greenhouse gases on a monthly or yearly time frame. It's really responding on decadal time frames. So there's no real shock from the change in greenhouse gases on the natural world. If we come out on a different trajectory, then in 10 years hence, we'll be in a different place.
I actually think that there's a lot that we can learn from this experience.
Dr. Philip Duffy is the president and executive director of the Woods Hole Research Center.
And in the case of climate change, there is this false argument, this false dichotomy of, well, we have a choice between having a safe climate and a healthy economy. And in the case of climate change, I know that that's just wrong, that it's just the opposite. In fact, the only way to have a healthy economy is to have a safe and stable climate.
Prior to joining Woods Hole, Duffy was a senior policy analyst in the White House Office of Science and Technology, where he helped formulate climate policy in the Obama administration. Do you think this period will in any way alter the political conversation that surrounds mitigation efforts?
Well, I hope it does. I think the most valuable lesson is listen to the experts. In the case of climate change, the experts have been jumping up and down about this for decades. This hasn't gotten any traction, and I suspect the fundamental reason is that it's hard for people to grasp that could actually happen, because we've never seen anything like it. And yet, COVID-19 is an example of the unimaginable can happen. Here it is. I mean, we knew theoretically this was possible, but nobody, on some emotional level, I think people didn't really believe it. We must not have, because we weren't ready for it. And here we are.
While the U.S. and much of Europe remain at a standstill, China has started to ease restrictions. Cars are back on the road and people are going to work. And as this animation from the European Space Agency shows, nitrogen dioxide levels have started to return as well.
Earlier this week, in the midst of the global coronavirus pandemic, the Trump administration relaxed automobile fuel efficiency standards, which were put in place under the Obama administration to combat climate change. I spoke with Coral Davenport, energy and environment policy reporter for the New York Times, about the potential consequences of this ruling.
This is a rollback of the federal government's largest regulation on climate change ever. It was the first and largest regulation on climate change. It was something that President Trump has been working on since his first days in office. Already, the Trump administration has rolled back over 100 environmental regulations in his first term, but this is by far the most consequential in terms of what the United States has done for climate change, and I think that is why it broke through.
Did the auto industry immediately push back when it went into effect or when the plans rolled out?
Well, the auto industry has been kind of muted on this, in part because it's just been completely slammed with both the economic impact, of course, of the coronavirus and the fact that companies are sort of wrangling with the White House over whether or not they're going to build ventilators. But there are now five major auto companies that have actually directly sided against the administration.
Is this because the auto manufacturers feel like, listen, I'm already planning on this, or is this the sort of California exception?
So here's what's going on with the auto companies. Several auto companies came to President Trump in the first days of his administration and said, look, the Obama administration has put in place this aggressive regulation on vehicle emissions. It's too hard for us to meet. We want some kind of relief from it. But what the auto companies were asking for was things like an extension of the deadlines or flexibility to kind of get credits for some of the things they were already doing. The Trump administration, President Trump said, okay, what I'm going to do is basically roll this whole thing back. And the auto companies actually pushed back over the past few years and said, no, no, we're not asking for that. Please do not roll the whole thing back. And here's why. They anticipated correctly that California and several other states, which have moved forward aggressively in having state-level emissions plans, were going to sue the federal government. And there was a good chance that they would win. And if they did, what the auto companies could end up with is sort of a scenario where the federal government has one set of vehicle pollution regulations and several states have a different set of vehicle pollution regulations. And that is the auto company's absolute nightmare scenario. That would give so much regulatory uncertainty, a complete different patchwork of different state and federal standards that they had to meet. And they're kind of looking down the barrel of that happening right now. So four companies joined with the state of California and said, look, we're just going to agree to meet these California standards. We don't want to do what the Trump administration is doing. We don't want to sort of, you know, head down a couple years of legal limbo until this hits the Supreme Court and then not know what's going to happen and know that there's like a pretty decent chance that the Trump administration could end up losing and they could end up with this sort of nightmare split state regulatory scenario.
What are the health consequences of this?
And the health consequences are significant. The Trump administration's own analysis found that it would lead to between 444 and 1,000 more deaths as a result of worse air pollution. So these are deaths due to premature deaths due to things like asthma, lung disease, other respiratory diseases. On the other side, the Trump administration said their numbers found that it would lead to 3,300 fewer deaths from auto fatalities. Their idea is that as a result of this regulation, cars will be about $1,000 cheaper. And their calculations are that consumers who are driving older cars will be more likely to give up those older, less safe cars, be more likely to buy newer, safer cars. And so that ultimately that would lead to fewer fatalities on the road. And that is the calculation that the administration is making. Essentially, there will be more deaths as a result of dirtier air, but fewer deaths as a result of more people driving newer cars. But you can be assured that the legal opponents of this are going to challenge that math.
And finally, what about the economic consequences? Adding this uncertainty in the marketplace at a time when the automakers are already trying to figure out how deeply coronavirus will impact their bottom lines.
Well, here's another case where the administration's own numbers may well work against it. In the administration's own calculations, they find that it could range between having an overall net benefit to the economy of about $6 billion. That's very much as a result of those new cars being bought, fewer auto fatalities, or ranging all the way to a net loss to the economy of $22 billion. And this is sort of depending on kind of what formulas you use, how much weight you put on some of these different economic consequences. And of course, those calculations were made before we entered into a public health fueled recession with a 13% unemployment rate. So, you know, this is going to hit an industry and an economy that is already reeling from a public health crisis. And so it really remains to be seen how these numbers are actually going to play out.
All right. Coral Davenport of the New York Times. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's all for this edition of PBS NewsHour Weekend. For the latest news updates, visit pbs.org/newshour. I'm Hari Srinivasan. Thanks for watching. Stay healthy and have a good night.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Bernard and Irene Schwartz, Sue and Edgar Walkenheim III, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein family, Rosalind P. Walter, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, Charles Rosenblum. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments.
When it comes to wireless, Consumer Cellular gives its customers the choice. Our no-contract plans give you as much or as little talk, text, and data as you want. And our U.S.-based customer service team is on hand to help. To learn more, go to consumercellular.tv.
Additional support has been provided by and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.